In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Have you ever wondered whether what you have to say matters? That your thoughts, your opinions, what you have to say on issues, does it matter? Of course it does. Why else would they work so hard to censor you? To censor people who think like you, who have the same opinions as you? And just to give you a sense of how much you matter, how much your voice matters, the other side is literally spending billions of dollars every year to silence you. That's how powerful all of you out there truly are. That the other side is willing to spend billions of dollars to keep your voice out of the public discussion. Think about it. Does the political right do this? Do they spend billions of dollars to silence the left? No. Do they own multi-billion dollar social media companies and then censor what the political left has to say on anything? No, they don't. And although the left has gotten ridiculously wealthy, in large part thanks to trillions of dollars from the U.S. taxpayer, despite all that wealth and power, think how fragile their ideology is, how fragile their belief system is. It is so fragile they will do anything to keep dissenting alternative viewpoints out of the public discussion. All it takes is a little light to shatter the darkness. That's why it is so important to keep fighting, to not give up, and to keep speaking up, to not be silent. And this is especially true when it comes to new laws, new legislation, new policies and new regulations, or doing away with old ones. If legislators only perceive one viewpoint being out there and not both sides or multiple sides to an issue, what will they think? Or how will they act or vote? They inevitably will condone the groupthink that is portrayed in the few channels they have with the greater public. In the wake of the 2020 election, there was a lot of outcry, but Twitter, Facebook, and especially the mainstream media all downplayed accusations of election irregularities, manipulation, outright malfeasance. That last one means wrongdoing or misconduct, especially by public officials. People, including myself, were banned from social media for daring to question the results, despite the fact that the left had just questioned the results 4 years before. The courts, aided and abetted by the predominant, "Oh, everything's fine, nothing to see here" narrative, ignored real evidence. In Congress, 100 congressmen demanded an investigation. Let's just take 10 days to look at the evidence to make sure everyone could trust the results. Let's at least take a look. But no. They wouldn't even look. They weren't allowed to look. And that never builds trust. In fact, it does the exact opposite. This whole situation regarding the 2020 election is like a bank robbery that at least half the country knows happened, but nothing is being done about it, other than the robbers have been able to keep the money they stole. I don't think we can move forward as a country until this robbery is addressed. Government must be founded on people of high ideals and high morals. Otherwise, if people of low moral standards not only take office, but are allowed to remain there, what government inevitably devolves to is legalized theft. But what can be done? Well, they need to be removed from office by any means necessary, and there just may be a way to do that. I'd like to welcome Lloyd Brunson to the show. He is one of the four Brunson brothers, a famous trumpet quartet from Utah that made appearances on The Tonight Show, Rose Bowl, and many others. But they're also all strong patriots, and he and his brothers filed two lawsuits related to the 2020 election, not to challenge the results, but to challenge the elected officials in Congress for failing to uphold their oaths of office. And one of these cases has made it to the Supreme Court. The other is still in federal court in Utah. Lloyd, thanks for joining us today to talk about all this.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. So talk to us about how these court cases came to be.
Well, my brother, who is the legal genius behind all this, he's not a lawyer, but he got pretty frustrated watching the congressional hearings that where they avoided the pleas from 100 witnesses to at least take a 10-day pause to investigate the crimes, mm-hmm. possible crimes and fraud. And so when he saw that so many just refused to just take a 10-day pause, especially our representative, Mike Lee, stood up there and held the Constitution up and said, I have a constitutional duty to certify this. And it's like, no, you don't, Mike. You do after the fraud claims are investigated. Right. Then you do. Right. You don't do it if, you know. So he decided he was going to use his experience that he had accrued over the last few years fighting banks because of the subprime mortgage loan problems that affected him. So he had been in state court, federal court, and even to the U.S. Supreme Court twice with petitions for writ of certiorari. So he decided he wanted to put his focus, his legal ability focus on that. And so he recruited myself and my other brother, who's a great programmer and really into this kind of stuff too, to just keep it all organized, decided to launch a federal lawsuit against 388 defendants, including a sitting president and vice president and 380 and Mike Pence and 385 sitting members of the United States House and United States Senate. So we started with me as being the plaintiff in federal court and went through a lot of blockage, a ton of blockage. We learned a lot from it too. And what we learned from it, we decided to apply to a whole new case while we kept that one going. So my brother, Roland J. Brunson, agreed to be the plaintiff on a second case. And with all this information and knowledge we had gained by the court and the federal judge blocking us and making us go through all kinds of stuff. So he filed in state court, which was interesting, and the U.S. attorneys moved it to federal court. And let me just say, at the get-go of this, we knew that we were pretty confident that we were going to lose in the lower courts.
Mm-hmm.
So my brother was prepared to take this all the way to the Supreme Court, and that's what we agreed to do. We would stay with this, regardless of the outcome, until we go all the way to the Supreme Court, and then it falls across the finish line. So my brother, as him as the plaintiff, while mine's stuck in federal court, he goes into the federal court of Utah from the state court. The U.S. attorneys removed it. They called me move it to the federal court and lost there. We battled, though. We didn't just give up quickly. We opposed the motion to dismiss. They filed a reply, and we just finally we got that out of the way. We just wanted decisions quickly so we could move up the ladder, and finally we get to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals with my brother's case, and we thought, great, this will be dismissed quickly, and then we can file a petition for writ of certiorari at the Supreme Court. And so we're waiting, and nothing happens. Weeks go by, months go by. Finally, it's like 4 or so months into this, we get together and think, this could just sit here forever.
Right.
There are three judges that make a decision at the 10th Circuit level. And so we just put my brother Ron and I put some pressure on my legal-minded brother and said, you've got to find something to fix this problem. He says, we can't. We are stuck. You cannot go to the Supreme Court. If we file a Supreme Court petition right now, they'll spit it back. They'll send it right back because we haven't gone to all the courts below. We've missed one. We got to wait for the circuit court. So we kind of put more pressure. Says, well, just try. If you feel like you can come up with something, do it. So a few days later, he called me and he says, I got it. I've got it. I found a Supreme Court Rule 11 that if we file this petition and prove to them that this is a national emergency type case, they can accept it should they choose to do it as a Rule 11 petition for writ of certiorari. So I think on the cover it said petition for writ of certiorari, U.S. Supreme Court, under, and then it would say this court's Rule 11. So it's a special petition. I wonder if anyone has ever even done a Rule 11 petition of the Supreme Court with a petition for writ of certiorari.
It's pretty amazing that you mention it. And maybe this is the door open for a lot of other cases as well. Let's go ahead and take a break there. And when we come back, we're going to pick that up because it is now in front of the Supreme Court. So we want to finish that story. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Lloyd Brunson talking about their case before the Supreme Court. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Lloyd Brunson. He and his brother Roland filed lawsuits against President Biden, Vice President Harris, former Vice President Pence, and 385 members of Congress for breaking their oath of office by voting against the proposition, which came from members of Congress to investigate the credible claims that there were enemies of the Constitution who had successfully rigged the 2020 election. And the lawsuit has now made it to the Supreme Court. So, but finish that story and how, in fact, that got there by using Rule 11.
Okay, yeah. So we're hoping that it'll, you know, be accepted because it's a national emergency, bypassing the 10th Circuit Court. So 5 days after we sent it, overnight, my brother gets a call from the Supreme Court, the clerk's office. Now, the clerk of the Supreme Court is not a clerk of the justice, of any of the justices. He is the clerk of the Supreme Court. For 11 years, Mark Sessions Harris, I believe his name, was the attorney for the Supreme Court. And he's the gatekeeper of the Supreme Court. So an analyst from his office calls my brother and says, we've decided to accept your Rule 11 petition. And what we'd like you to do is we'd like you to include some things that we've seen on the federal docket. So they're asking us to include things that are not required. And so, and then they said, how soon could you get it to us? Get it to us as soon as you can. So he said, okay. So we got working on that. And when you file a petition for the Supreme Court, it has to be formatted a specific way. And by the way, exact replicas are available at 7discoveries.com, where you can order an exact replica stamped by the court. Mm-hmm. And so, here we go ahead and we put this all together and we go to the printers and it has to be bound. So we're having it perfect bound is what they request. And just before it's perfect bound, all printed ready to go, we get a notice from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals that they have made a decision. I thought, this is strange. Did they hear about this? So they make a decision. And so my brother calls the clerk's office. They give him a number so they could call directly. She always picks up. She's the case analyst. And he tells them that the 10th Circuit has made a decision. What do we do? Should we take out the Rule 11 part of it or just leave it in and send it to them? And she said, no, take it out. You don't need it. Just make sure you put in what we asked you to put in. And how soon can you get it to us? And he says, well, it's going to take about 2 weeks. And she says, can you do better than that? How soon? Can you get it to us sooner? This stunned all of us when he told us about this.
Yeah.
And he says, well, we'll try. We'll do the best we can. He says, okay, get it to us as soon as you can. So we got it together. We went to the printers, and I think they put it on a fast track because they saw what this was. And the binders helped us out by kind of putting us in front of some others, I think. And on the 20th of October, we expressed mailed it to the Supreme Court. They got it on Monday the 24th, and they docketed it on, no, they got it Friday. We sent it Thursday. They got it Friday. They docketed it on Monday and docketed it as filed on the day we sent it, which is standard procedure. So there it is now. The U.S. attorneys have notified that they have 30 days to respond. They only have one opportunity to oppose this petition before it goes to conference. That is it. We've done our share, our side, with a petition. Now it's up to them. And so they have till the 23rd of November. They don't do it. On the 23rd of November, they still hadn't done it. We thought they're gonna miss the deadline, and then it goes to conference. Well, at the last minute, we got a notice that on the docket it now reflected that the U.S. attorneys were no longer representing the 388 defendants. But the new counsel, the new attorney representing the 388 defendants, is the United States Solicitor General. So she files a notice of appearance. She's now the attorney representing the defendants. And then she also files a waiver, waiving their right to extend, to take time to file an opposition. She signed a waiver, waiving all their rights to file any kind of an opposition before it goes to conference. So the next step is it goes to conference. When is that going to happen? So we keep watching the docket, and finally, I think, was it yesterday morning? Time's, I'm getting confused. Time. Anyway, so the docket now reflects that the conference, where the nine justices get together by themselves without any representation from either side of this case, they get together by themselves and they look at any opposition, they look at the petition, and they make a decision. They take nine votes, they all nine vote, and if four of the votes are to move this forward, it moves forward to the full-blown hearing, which I like to call trial, in front of the justices.
Well, it's interesting that you don't even need a full majority in order to move that forward. So
right.
Just to back up a bit, that must have been really stunning that the Solicitor General there decided not to try to intervene here and just let it move forward. What do you make of that?
Well, I think she probably read the petition, and she probably got a tear in her eye and realized that this is about the Constitution and the oath of office and the oath she took. It's really, this petition is an expose on the Constitution that shows the complaint. So we're hoping that she just, her conscience was pricked, and it's not about a party. It's not about a Republican or a Democrat. It's about the Constitution that she's sworn to uphold.
Right. Well, and just to back up a little bit in case people missed it, your case is not about challenging the outcome of the 2020 election. You're not trying to overthrow that. You're trying to say by ignoring witness statements and this actual investigation that 100 members of Congress had wanted to do, the other ones that voted against it have failed to uphold their oath to defend and support the Constitution.
Exactly. Defend it from a security breach. The evidence, they should have said, this could lead to really evil, powerful players.
Absolutely.
In destroying this country. So that's why in the complaint, which the Supreme Court has the full power to adjudicate, they can judge the whole complaint because it's a national emergency level. It's not just about upholding or overturning a decision. So the proper remedy would be to remove every single one of them from office and barring them from holding public office in the United States right down to the local level for the rest of their lives. The Supreme Court now has the power to do that, not just remove every one of them from office, but to bar them from holding public office the rest of their lives. Mm. And then there's some other rules too in the complaint.
And that notion right there, that the Supreme Court could actually hold these people liable for failing to uphold their oath of office and remove them from these elected positions, I mean, that's stunning to think that that's even possible. So, okay.
And then the states can replace those people. They get busy and replace them. Look, we don't have a Congress when they're out of session. What's the big deal? Just now get the states going and replace them with representatives that want to be accountable for their oath of office, because this strips the immunity from them. And now
what a shocker. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Come back. We'll continue this with Lloyd Brunson and their case before the Supreme Court. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Lloyd Brunson. He and his brothers have filed a lawsuit, which is at the Supreme Court right now. And his case, Lloyd's case, is still held up in court in Utah, while the exact same case, just with his brother Rollins' name on it, is before the Supreme Court right now. They seek to hold Congress, the president, the vice president, and former Vice President Mike Pence liable for violating their oath of office, which would give the Supreme Court the ability to remove them from office. And this is really rather shocking to think about, that the Supreme Court could just go in and remove these 385 members of Congress and the president and vice president as well. I think it's hard for people to even imagine that this is not only possible, but might in fact happen. What would that look like? Have you guys kind of game planned the scenarios at all?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Absolutely. We think it could be a pretty smooth transition, actually. The court orders the U.S. Marshals to take a court order and a list of defendants to the sergeant in arms, and every single person on that list, the sergeant in arms, would be required under law or penalty of going to jail. If he doesn't, he would be required to cancel the credentials of every single member of Congress that is on that list. And they could do the same, similar to the president and vice president. They could actually go to the Federal Communications Commission and with special teams and let the Federal Communications Commission directors realize that they have a problem and that they are being temporarily replaced, and they could have special teams going to the networks, the national networks, broadcast teams, special broadcast teams. And so you could see your television go dark maybe for a minute or two or whatever, and then you would see new people, new faces, explaining what had just happened and showing them from then on news that they could verify with their own eyes. They would finally be seeing the truth.
Well, what just such a novel concept to think that here we'd have elected officials actually being forced to uphold their own oath of office.
How about that?
It shouldn't have to come to that, but that's where we are. So just
this has been a problem for a long time.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I want to talk to you a little bit about that here. But just to go back a little bit, you guys have really had smooth sailing in some ways to get this in front of the Supreme Court.
We've had a lot of hurdles.
Yeah, you have had a lot of hurdles, and I don't mean to downplay that at all. But to get it into the Supreme Court, to bypass all of those hurdles, you had the clerk helping you guys out, and then I forget her name, but anyway, she decided not to challenge us. So that's shocking. But getting back to that clerk,
Solicitor General.
Yes, thank you. So what were the, some of the things that they had asked you to include in that writ?
Okay, it was actually they're dotting their I's and crossing their T's. If there was any kind of a complaint from the Solicitor General who's representing them now, or U.S. Attorney, saying this wasn't fair, you know, something happened and you just got the petition, you didn't get our side of the story, they could say to her, oh, you kidding? What we did is we asked the Brunsons if they wouldn't mind putting your motion to dismiss in the petition. So it's all there. So you can't say that we didn't look at your side of the story.
That's really interesting. So getting back to this notion of actually fulfilling your oath of office to support and defend the Constitution, part of that, you guys have done some of your own previous research looking at sovereign immunity and also how that has now become essentially a means to protect these elected officials from basically any wrongdoing. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, it's very simple. And this is one of the part of the complaint, part of the petition. Article 6 of the Constitution is very clear. It requires that our representatives be bound by oath. Mm. Not that they're required to take an oath, but they're required to be bound by oath. So them being bound in earlier years, many years ago, they started coming up with ways to get around it. So yes, they've actually given them federal statutes, U.S. Code Title 28 is part of that, where they've given themselves immunity. So this case would literally strip and take down those statutes that protect them from the consequences that they should receive from violating their oath of office. So this would change the whole playing ground. Politicians, if this is successful, criminals wouldn't want to run for office because they would be accountable. They wouldn't be able to commit crimes in office like they're doing now.
Absolutely. And you guys have also produced a documentary called The Oath of Office, The Thread by Which the Constitution Hangs. And you guys have looked at a perjury statute in California. It excludes politicians, as I understand it, being bound from Article 6 of the Constitution. And as you say, this case could strip these officials of their immunity.
Absolutely.
So talk to us a little bit about that perjury statute.
Okay. Well, the way I read it was the perjury penalty was they excluded it from politicians regarding the oath of office. In other words, if they take an oath and they're lying and they're committing perjury, they can't be held accountable for perjury. Mm. And that's the wording in California. It's unbelievable. It's like these guys know.
Yeah.
They know that the oath is supposed to be binding, but they've tricked us into thinking, well, Mike Lee was the first person I was interviewing. I like Mike. And before he ran for U.S. Senate, when he was running for U.S. Senate for the first time, and I says, what's the penalty for breaking the oath of office? And he says, you lose the election. There's the problem. They all think that there's no penalty for breaking the oath of office.
Mm, mm.
They all think that it's not a binding oath. It's like, if it's not binding, what kind of an oath are you taking?
Yeah.
You're supposed to be bound by oath. How's it binding? You lose. You know, we should have continued that conversation.
Oh.
And that's a great one to have with people.
Oh, exactly. And one of the more astounding legal rulings from the many hurdles that you guys face, this was February 2nd, 2022, and it was Rollins' case. Judge Hill Parrish dismissed Rollins' lawsuit, claiming that, quote, the defendants have sovereign immunity protecting them from aiding the enemies of the Constitution because it was done while acting in the capacity of their office. I mean, that's like saying Congress can commit treason just as long as they did it while in office.
Right. That's been their only defense. As a matter of fact, we used their admittance in Rollins' case for my case, and we brought action against the federal court and the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. We took them to state court because they were blocking my case. And after we went through that for a while, even though I lost, a few weeks later, the federal court not only unblocked my case, but they sent us a notice that they had filed it and ordered the clerk to issue 388 summonses. So that's still alive. So it's like they're learning as we're doing this for the first time. No one's challenged them on these levels.
Well, it is just shocking that they haven't been challenged. I want to make sure that we mention your website, 7discoveries.com, and people can go there. They can help support you guys. They can make donations. They can download some of the documents and whatnot. And again, that's the number 7discoveries.com. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. But unfortunately, we are up against the clock here with you. Loy, I want to thank you so much. We're definitely going to have you back on all this.
Let's do it. Thank you.
The conference hearing for the Brunson Brothers case is scheduled for, get this, January 6, 2023. Coincidence or God-driven? Of course it's God-driven. Everything is God-driven. Be Praying, and help support their efforts. 7discoveries.com. Everyone knows YouTube and other big tech censor voices they don't approve of, but is that about to change? We'll talk about censorship boomeranging on Big Tech next. And welcome back. We just got done talking with Lloyd Brunson about his case before the Supreme Court, which seeks to hold Congress and other elected officials accountable for violating their oath of office to uphold and defend the Constitution. Free speech is part of the Constitution, and now we're going to talk about when free speech is banned, censorship, and do that with Joe Mobley, a member of Project 21, which is part of National Center for Public Policy Research, one of our favorite organizations. Joe, it is great to talk to you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, before we get into big tech censorship, tell us a bit about your show. What's your focus?
Oh, yeah. My show, The Joe Mobley Show, is it's an uncloseted conservative show. And really, it's uncloseted anything. I found myself in a meeting, a digital meeting on Teams at one of the largest consulting firms in the world, in the wake of the George Floyd's death, I'll say it that way. And I realized that I was the only black male on the call. And I was gripped with fear because I knew someone was going to ask me to say something, and I was going to say something wildly unpopular. So I did. It was well received by most, poorly received by others, and that kind of led me to start a podcast.
Well, cool. Good for you. And people can find that by heading to thejoemobleyshow.com, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. So you had written an article for the Daily Caller, "The Walls Are Closing In on Big Tech," in which you say, quote, "YouTube is back to its old tricks, strengthening Ted Cruz's argument that big tech censorship is the single biggest threat that we have to free speech in this country. But Steven Crowder may have just struck the fatal blow to YouTube and other big tech platforms." So tell our audience how YouTube's own censorship may have bit them in the rear end.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when your channel gets banned, which mine has, my YouTube channel is permanently banned, I understand, you've got a choice. You can take your ball and go home, or you can throw up another channel and try and get a little following, or you can ask your audience, you can say, hey, pretty please, will you go with me to this other platform? Steven Crowder's been signaling that kind of messaging for a good long time. Many digital creators, myself included, have done that, and it paid off majorly for him because he, you know, his YouTube channel is huge. It's over 5 million subscribers, and he just has, I think, 1.something million on Rumble. But that Rumble stream on election night was truly a record-setting stream, not just for Rumble, but actually for digital streaming of any kind, to include YouTube, to include, you know, mainstream media channels with their millions of followers and their billion-dollar budgets. Mm-hmm. Crowder just blew it out of the water on what they call an alt-media platform.
Right. Yeah, so just to back up a little bit, in 2020, Crowder's streaming show, Louder with Crowder, it had set a new record for election night coverage, but then YouTube responded by pulling the stream down in the middle of the coverage, which is just galling beyond belief. But then, like you say, he moved to Rumble and set these records. So also, you guys at Project 21 had your own battle with big tech censorship. You guys had two YouTube videos pulled down. Talk to us about that. What happened?
Absolutely, we did. We, you know, sometimes YouTube sends notice and, you know, this is the video and this is the particular community guidelines violations, or sometimes they just give you the big broad. This video, your content, your channel, or just you violate our, quote, community guidelines, and they don't point you to a specific policy where you can see, oh, this is indecent language, or this is, you know, harmful, abusive, something like that.
Right.
The center, the National Center, got a couple of videos pulled, and it's kind of a shell game because you can get as many strikes as you can handle, but you can only get three strikes within a 90-day period. Now, big tech, YouTube, Alphabet, Google, who owns YouTube, they can go back as far as they want. They can go back to your first breath on the internet, so to speak. My personal channel, The second strike that I got was from an interview that I did more than a year ago. It was the summer of 2021. I interviewed Senator Dick Black, retired Senator Dick Black, and half of it we talked about school board issues, freedom of speech, and seriously about 45 minutes of the show was just breathtaking stories from his experience as a pilot in Vietnam and the members of his team that he lost over there. And it was really a heartfelt interview. Mm-hmm. And me and my co-host, both of us veterans ourselves, we were just speechless listening to him. Now, some 18 months after that, YouTube actually gave me a strike. They cited no policy at all. So the National Center, we did get notice of what episodes and what violations the content, which is really, it's tantamount to holding an unauthorized opinion.
Really?
But, yeah. You know, the interview with Dick Black, no explanation at all. And my third strike came 1 week before the election. So just literally said the Tuesday before midterm elections 2022, no video was cited and no policy was cited. I got an automated email from Big Google that said that my account was just blasted, just removed from the internet. Wow. And that includes all of the playlists that I've made. Like if you like a YouTube video or if you've got a little play, I have a playlist of worship music and workouts and some
so they just flat out erased things. You then
absolutely. Wow. If you go to it or if I even try and log in through that old account, a box pops up that's just permanently deleted, and I can't even go and get the videos that I've liked over the last 10 years.
Wow that's
really,
that's crazy.
Amazing.
It is. So the issue though, as far as YouTube's censoring is concerned, it's not just them doing the censoring, it's YouTube's parent company Google. Because when YouTube censors something, searches for it or the topic is also censored from search results from Google. So it's not just that something isn't being allowed to be watched on YouTube, but Google essentially makes it disappear as if it doesn't exist at all, which when it comes to things like global warming, it creates the appearance that everyone believes global warming is real because the search results never show any arguments against it. So and you said something very similar, actually, in your article. Big tech holds content hostage with its vague and inconsistently enforced community guidelines. Account suspension means no one on the internet can see your message, rally behind your cause, or even know that you exist. And I think that's the real danger there.
It is. And to add to that, you know, it wasn't just this year that Senator Cruz has been warning about big tech, about censorship and free speech ramifications. He's been speaking about this for, I want to say, since 2016 or 18 at the latest. When we don't have the ability to offer a dissenting opinion, mm-hmm. then we're really, truly in trouble.
Yes.
Again, I imagine that the regulators are all over you, so I want to make things crystal clear for the FCC. We don't endorse violence. We are not calling for violence. This is a historical fact and more of a philosophical, esoteric statement for you to digest in your mind, okay? So, you know, on the heels of a January 6th, I want to be specific and clear with my language.
Really, it's crazy.
You know, great philosophers... the great philosophers of old, all the way up to Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, say, hey, and the founders knew this, rebellion comes out of a depressed opinion, a depressed population not being able to air their grievances.
Yes, absolutely.
That's why speech and thought in this Orwellian existence is incredibly dangerous.
Yep.
No one wants conflict. We just want our day in court, our day on the internet.
Yeah, just
we want to go to the public square and speak.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep, just want to be heard. Orwellian is exactly right. Let's go and take a break. It's not just that YouTube censors, it's Facebook, Twitter, and more. We'll continue our discussion with Joe Mobley about censorship in the digital age. Stay with us. For over 26 years, Project 21 has been a leading voice of Black conservatives and is sponsored by the National Center for Public Policy Research, one of our favorite organizations. They're not just a think tank, but a do tank, a let's take action and kick down some doors tank. Joining us now is one of Project 21's members, Joe Mobley, who is also the host of his own show, The Joe Mobley Show. Find out more about Project 21 by heading to nationalcenter.org and look for Project 21 under the Programs tab. And Joe's show can be found at thejoemobleyshow.com. Mobley is M-O-B-L-E-Y, Mobley, Joe, thejoemobleyshow.com. And, of course, we'll link all of that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And so, Joe, it's no surprise to us or to our audience to hear YouTube or Facebook or any of the other big tech firms are censoring political speech they don't like. We personally experienced that with our own Facebook page when we paid for ads and they took our money, but they wouldn't actually place the ads for show promos about Islamic extremism or exposing climate change fraud. But now Twitter is looking like they may pull back a little bit on the reins on censorship. Recently, they announced that they would no longer censor what had been deemed COVID disinformation by its programmers. Now it's okay to talk about hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin and to criticize the vaccines. How far do you think this will go as far as pulling back censorship there on Twitter? Is it all smoke and mirrors, or do you think they're serious about it?
It's a complicated question, Mark. I think they are serious about it. It's not enough for one platform to try and have this reform. And just like Congress isn't going to put limits on their own, term limits or limits on their own budgetary power, salaries, things like that. Really, the limitations for big tech are going to come from we the people, and they're going to come from lawsuits. And there are a number of Section 230 lawsuits on the docket right now. Jason Fick, whom I just interviewed last week, has one of those cases, and it's awesome, but it's going to kind of free the internet, if you will. There's been this misunderstanding about a platform versus the platform, and that definite versus indefinite article makes a huge difference as a matter of law. And is it a publisher or a platform? Because big tech has definitely been allowed to have their cake and eat it too.
Right.
And that gravy train is coming to a stall. So we just need to hang in there. I think it's going to be set right across all platforms, and there are going to be major disruptions and layoffs to the big players.
Well, I would certainly hope so. I don't know much about that lawsuit, so I'll have to look that up. Can you describe a little bit about his approach on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are basically two major provisions, Section 230C1 and C3, one of which is governing, it's kind of describing what a platform can do, and the other is describing what a publisher can do, and they are conflating the two, and the kind of the linchpin there is a publisher, by way of publishing, endorses everything that it puts out, a magazine, a newspaper, mainstream news. So they editorialize, which is their prerogative, because they are endorsing whatever it is that's on their platform. Now, a platform is not seen in the eyes of the law as a publisher, so they can't be held liable. But if they editorialize, then they can be held liable. The courts have not upheld this because you and I both know Twitter, Facebook, all of these big social media platforms, all of these big tech platforms, they have, through content moderation, they've editorialized.
Mm-hmm.
They've altered content. They've forced us to alter content, to alter tweets or posts, or basically alter our beliefs. No longer believe 2 + 2 = 4 on their platforms. That's living in the C1 and the C3. You can't, the Section 230 C1 and C3, you can't have it both ways. Either you're a platform and you don't own the statements, you're not responsible for the statements, or you're a publisher and you do own and you are responsible for the statements. And as a user, we sign these agreements that says, hey, I will purchase ads or sell ads and put content onto this thing because we are acting in each other's mutual best interest. And we, the consumer, we've held up our end of the deal. Section 230 and the misunderstandings of law and the suppression of the cases has really allowed them to not hold up their end.
Well, I'm glad to hear that that's the approach, because in a platform, I think of those as like the old message boards way back in the early advent of the internet, where you just had a means by which you could say what you want to say. But you're right, is that when these companies start deciding what people are allowed to say and then pulling the plug on them if they don't like it, that's clearly falling into the role of a publisher. I mean, that's the publisher's entire job, is to decide what to bring to market to let people see.
Exactly. And I'm watching the clock, so I'll keep this remark short. But you mentioned that essential difference, and really the reason that Google Alphabet even purchased YouTube is because YouTube is primarily a search engine. It's not just for cat videos and entertainment. This is where some days 90% of searches will be for how to do something will be executed on YouTube. And when they cut us out, when they cut half the population out, then you can't find out how to become a precinct committeeman or how to do something that the big tech oligarchs don't like. So that's what we're facing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. When it comes to big tech, it's not just censorship and taking down unfavored opinions. It's also what they allow and push. I'm talking about government propaganda. We'll talk about that next with Joe Mobley from Project 21. And welcome back. This is our final segment here on the iSpire Radio Show. We're talking with Joe Mobley. He's a member of Project 21, which has been a leading voice of black conservatives for more than two decades. It is one of several projects of the National Center for Public Policy Research. You can find out more about them by heading to nationalcenter.org, nationalcenter.org, and just look at the top there for their projects. And it's one of, I think, four that they have going right now. Joe also has his own show. Find out more about that by heading to thejoemobleyshow.com. And Mobley is M-O-B-L-E-Y, thejoemobleyshow.com. And, of course, we'll link all of that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. So, Joe, it's now been revealed that government agencies were actively working with big tech to push its version of things, especially about COVID and the vaccines. And it's one thing when a private company decides to censor something. It's quite another when the government is using private companies to push their own propaganda. What should be done here, do you think?
Oh, man. Well, what I think should be done is criminal prosecutions, Mark. And one, because, fascism, socialism, communism, they get thrown around a lot. They're different terms. But really, communism is that merger between private companies and the government, which is incredibly dangerous. It's anti-American. And there's really no method by which in American law, under United States Code or the Constitution, to make that happen. So what the government has done is illegal any way you try and slice it. And that is, I've been in this space. I've worked in law enforcement and I've worked in government contracts and with the government for more than a decade. What they've done, if I did, I'd be in prison. If you did, you'd be in prison. They've seen something that's inherently illegal for the government to try and do. A 1983 violation, which is a constitutional right, a civil right, something like that. And they said, since we can't do it, we're going to ask that a private company does it on our behalf. Well, that's a distinction without a difference there.
Right.
And because the government's done it, it's another shell game. I don't mean to use the same analogy for two different things, but it's a wonderfully crafted shell game. And they got caught. They've been caught several times. Elon Musk has all of the receipts, as they say.
Yes.
And which is probably something that was unforeseen, an unforeseen circumstance to many different decision makers. And, what's done in the darkness will come to light. They did this and they need to own up to it. And it's good for the healing of the country to get this out in daylight and get it corrected.
Yes. I think that is really key going forward, is being able to expose all of this. I mean, we really need a full accounting, and future communications should be flagged as from the government, not a private company or source. But you raise a really interesting point, which I think is going to be fascinating going forward. As you said, Elon Musk has all the receipts, and he's literally got the private messages going between these government officials and big tech. But also on top of that, he's got all these human trafficking accounts that were allowed to continue. Heaven forbid you talk about vaccines, but human trafficking and child trafficking, that apparently was okay by Twitter's censors, and now he's got all of those private messages. So that's definitely going to be really interesting going forward. The other thing that is happening here is that Facebook has recently announced that they are going to be removing any postings with religious content in news feeds starting early December. So here we are entering the holiday seasons, and for heaven's sakes, you better not talk about Christmas. They don't say anything about what is being said. How can they get away with that without lawsuits? What are your thoughts on this?
There'll probably be lawsuits, and here's where I will get some angry mail. Don't send that to Mark. Send your angry letters to ask@bgmobileshow.com, and I'll put it in the spam folder so I don't get any more of those. And now, as a private company, they are allowed to make the rules of their sandbox as they please. They must enforce them equally in all situations with rare exception, which is something that they've not done. They censor based on political ideological beliefs.
Right.
We know this. So if they want, for whatever reason, to ostracize Christians, and, you know, you can also include the other major religions, Islam, Buddhism, what have you, if they choose to not allow that on their platform, that's their prerogative. It will be a costly mistake. It will cost them hundreds of billions of dollars, and millions of monthly active users will leave the platform, obviously. Now, that's something they can do. The lawsuits will not go through unless they don't apply it evenly. Specifically, if they ban Christian speak, you know, for lack of a better term, on the platform, but they allow Islam and Buddhism and other world religions,
or even
then
atheism,
they have a problem.
Yeah, or even atheism.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, then they'd have a problem, an equal protections issue.
Yeah. Well, I don't feel bad for Facebook if they get sued for billions of dollars. In fact, I'd love to see that happen. You know, what I really wish would happen is some of the companies that currently advertise on there start pulling their ad dollars. Because, I mean, this is crazy that here you are going into the Christmas season and they're literally saying you shouldn't be talking about religion. That's absurd. I think that's crazy.
Yeah. Stranger than fiction.
Yeah. Well, Joe, unfortunately, we are up against the clock here. I want to thank you so much for your time. His radio show is thejoemobleyshow.com, thejoemobleyshow.com. There's an E in there, M-O-B-L-E-Y. And, of course, we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. Joe, thanks so much for your thoughts today, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime in the near future.
Thanks, Mark.
In case you've looked for me on Twitter after their big amnesty this week, I am still not on there. The censors on Twitter refused to lift my ban for daring to criticize socialized medicine, and I refuse to take it down, because it is 100% true. I'll post a screen capture of it on today's show page at iSpyRadio.com. See what you think. Let me know if I deserve to be banned. And while you're there, do share that page and the information and the links on it, especially the Brunson Supreme Court case and their website. Remember, if you're unable to fight directly, help those who are in the fight. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.